A deep dive into the East End of Long Island, New York, with people who are committed to making our beautiful community and the world a more enlightened place. We prize good vibes and offer hope for a brighter, more sustainable future. Join us as we explore at Hamptons Consciousness, the real Hamptons.
Hi guys, welcome to Hamptons Consciousness. It's Enid, JB, and we're here with Erica Serino today. She's a science writer, author, and artist exploring the intersection of the human and non-human worlds. She has a new book out, which is why she's here with us. Thicker Than Water, It's a Quest for Solutions to the Plastic Crisis. She documents plastic across ecosystems and elements, shares stories from the indigenous and rural communities are most harmed by industrial pollution globally. She uncovers strategies working to prevent plastic from further devastating our planet and its inhabitants. Some really awesome things from such a young person. Hi, Erica. Thank you so much for taking time out of your book tour to cast with us. Just wanted to let you guys know that I am broadcasting from Penn Station. It doesn't get any more Long Island than that. And we're all actually Up Islanders in the studio today, even though I'm remote. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
The first question that we had, how was living in Long Island influential in what you actually became in terms of your work for the environment?
Right.
How did that happen?
So growing up, I didn't live in a necessarily easy household, and nature was always my refuge. I luckily grew up near the woods, near the beach, so I could always spend time outside. Long Island is really suburban and very fast-paced, consumeristic, and very different from how I am in my interior life. So that kind of pushed me to really seek out other places in nature, and the ocean turned out to be one of them. It was a place for great reflection for me.
And in the book, you talk about sailing as part of your therapy. Can you go into a little bit more detail on that as well?
Yeah, so sailing is a very difficult task. There are challenges every day, every minute, and it is an endless amount of work. However, it is also this very meditative practice. I mean, being on the ocean and required to sail for 8 hours a day, plus cleaning, cooking, and then the required rest it takes to be having enough energy to keep going. It's a fully immersive experience, and it really boils down to survival and living and experiencing, whereas we have so many distractions back on land. So it was a place where I could really focus on the task at hand.
And it must have been shocking for you, though, when you found this place of refuge, and then further in your professional development, you saw the extent of the damage of plastic to
right.
this environment.
Right. It was almost an incredible thing to sail into the garbage patch, and initially I did not see any garbage. It was more of a clean blue sea. And then I took a closer look, and suddenly the debris of humanity was all around the ship. And we were living on an extremely simple ship, an old steel boat that had been constructed in Belgium and was then owned by Danish people. And it was a mixture of researchers and scientists and sailors all on the boat. And yet our life was so simple. There was no kind of entertainment. There was no shopping. There's no nothing to do on the boat except for working and doing the research. So it was an unbelievable juxtaposition of the trash around us and then the simple life on the ship that we were leading.
It must have felt like you were violated, though, right? When you're out there in such peaceful, beautiful nature and to see this, you know, this stuff everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, we were wondering, where did it come from? And you'd see a light bulb float by, a fluorescent light bulb, a fishing crate, a buoy, we saw a shampoo bottle. I mean, there were just endless number of human objects and artifacts. And more worryingly, when those items break up in the ocean, they break up into these little particles. You can't see it in the podcast, but I brought some microplastic with me.
I'm looking at the microplastic, and it's really insidious because it looks like beautiful shells.
Yeah.
But as your book well documents, is that probably they are toxic and leach, I guess, would be how does the really dangerous chemicals of industrialization bond with the plastic that's everywhere?
Right. So first I'll point out that the chemistry of plastic is grounded in the fossil fuel industry because it is derived from oil or gas plastic. So adding to plastic to make it, you have to have additives and plasticizers that give it color, texture, shape, how hard it is, how malleable it is. It can influence what type of plastic you get, because obviously we have different plastics for different purposes. And the chemical part of it is that a lot of these additives and plasticizers can change human hormones. They can influence whether or not we get cancer. And it's not necessarily like an immediate cause, but, you know, with all the plastic around us, as the toxins build up in us and in our environment, we're more at risk of seeing those negative effects of the chemicals on us. And it's been shown in other animal species. That's the thing that people don't understand is that, you know, we see whales influenced by toxics in the ocean. And, you know, how are we different? It's kind of funny that we're thinking that we're immune to the issues. However, we are around plastic and these plastic particles known as microplastic at all times in the air, in the water, in the food we eat. So we're exposed.
One of the things that struck me by reading the book was the, like, climate change, the sheer enormity
right.
of the problem of plastics. And also I was struck by the fact that the mainstream media isn't more alarmist about it or covering these issues more. And I was also struck by the irony that here you have dedicated environmentalists and scientists on a boat.
Right.
Where are the big tankers from the oil companies cleaning up the mess that they left?
Yeah, there's very little accountability on behalf of the major corporations extracting and processing fossil fuels and making plastic. And it's really alarming. With the acceleration of climate change, the climate crisis, oil and gas companies are now banking on plastic. So it is kind of this insidious material that is going to keep harming people, harming the planet, as long as businesses keep doing business as usual, which is the plan, because it creates the most amount of income. And so we're at this critical point with the climate crisis, with the plastic crisis, is asking the question, is money worth more than human life? And I really hope that most people answer that question as, no, money is not more important than human life.
It would seem to me, though, that based on your experiences and also your journey with respect to plastic, that we're kind of, it's going to be incumbent upon all of us to make changes, right? Not
right.
just hold corporations accountable, but specifically lifestyle changes. Could you go into detail on that as well?
Yeah. So, I mean, I know a lot of people who are dedicated to addressing the plastic crisis, and I see a lot of people saying, oh, it's the corporations, it's the corporations. And that is very true in many respects. However, we also have to take accountability. I mean, we are part of the throwaway life cycle. A major issue is that the corporations have sold to us as recycling plastic as the answer. And it turns out very little plastic is being recycled compared to other materials like glass or metal or paper. But, you know, it's not just about recycling. It's about totally transforming the way we look at stuff, material stuff, and our throwaway culture. So, you know, why do we buy things? We have to ask these questions. What do I need to live and what can I live without, really? And that's what I was asking myself on that boat, because I realized, oh gosh, we don't even have a shower on this boat. We don't have a toilet. We're all using the same bucket. That's a detail when I share with kids, they like squeal with laughter. And I'm like, well, imagine that. And I was having the richest, most amazing experience. And those creature comforts didn't matter. I didn't give it any thought on a daily basis, only when I was sitting on the bucket trying not to fall into the ocean across the deck.
But it must have been a shock to, after that experience, to come back to, quote, the consumer
society. Oh, it was unbelievable.
Society. And then you're probably more aware of just how ridiculous so much of this is, right?
I mean, we landed in Honolulu after breaking the rudder on our boat, after losing the engine, after pooping in the same bucket, 8 other people for 24 days. And then, like, Honolulu is this, like, shining beacon. And I describe in the book, like, I tried to give the feelings that I was feeling at the time when I stepped off, but, like, super wobbly, super, like, my head was buzzing. It was just too much stimulation in front of me. Like, so many people, so many cars, so many noises. And being out on the ocean is just, like, a handful of noises you hear. It's day, it's night, there's a little storm, you know. The conditions are super variable, but at the same time, it's nowhere near as distracting as being on land.
In the book, you talk about the albatross.
Right.
And I wanted you to just touch on that, because it seems that people, when it comes to crisis, like, they have to have physical examples of it. Like, a lot of what you write about is like climate change. It's hard to wrap your arms and hands around the thing, because it's so slow moving in
right.
one sense, and it's not immediate.
Right.
So go ahead.
Tell me. that's a great point. And a lot of these crises that have unfolded, these environmental crises, I would think of maybe deforestation, pollution, like toxins, and also plastic. And then, of course, the climate crisis, that they haven't necessarily happened in a very visual format up until this time, but now we're kind of reaching this critical point where the tipping of the scale is towards disaster rather than being on a balance. But the albatrosses, so albatrosses are these gorgeous birds. I saw many of them when I was sailing, of various species. And they come every year to nest around this time, actually. They'll come back to land. And these are birds that can stay for years out at sea, just feeding on squid and other creatures in the surface. They come back to land to mate and have lay eggs and have babies. So when this happens, the adults will fly back and they'll feed the baby chicks as they circle the islands for this period, this brooding period. And then they'll go back out to sea and fledge. Those baby birds will become adults. And then they won't come back to land themselves for several years. But while they're being fed by their parents, they can't fly yet. And the parents will bring back, it turns out, a lot of plastic. And so I sailed with Chris Jordan, who's a photographer, filmmaker, and artist who brings attention to mass consumption in his artwork and has taken these incredibly shocking photos of deceased albatrosses that were nesting on Midway Atoll, which is a major nesting place for albatrosses. So these pictures, you'll have to look at them to understand them, but you'll just see a bird brimming with plastic. He cuts them open after death, and then it reveals the plastic inside. And it's very clear that this bird died because it was just stuffed with plastic. There's no room for any food or nourishment. And it's heartbreaking. I would say I find it particularly heartbreaking because I grew up from age 15 to 21 working as a wildlife rehabilitator. I'm still licensed today, and I take in animals that are sick, injured, and orphaned. And in so many cases, plastic is the cause of the problem. Yeah, in fact, the whole reason I started writing and taking photos was because I wanted to prevent that from happening, you know, into the future. You know, being a rehabilitator, we treat symptoms of problems, but what if we prevent the problem? That was my point of view. But the albatrosses specifically, you take a look at that and you'll feel something for sure.
It seems to me that, like all of our crises, environmental on our planet right now, that the cost falls disproportionately not only on animals that are vulnerable, but as you mentioned in the book, people that are socioeconomically disadvantaged. Can you go into that a little bit for me?
Yeah, I was shocked. So, of course, my understanding of the plastic crisis started with the wildlife. That's why it is a big part of my book, because from an early age, I was experiencing these creatures suffering up close, and that was really shocking to me. But we have a huge crisis on our hands now, too, because a lot of people I speak to say, oh, like, plastic pollution is bad because it's a blight on the earth. But it's not just that. It's not just this visual garbage. It's literally killing people, and particularly people of color, indigenous people, low-income people, those on the so-called fence line of industrial development and the disposal places for our plastic trash. And I've tried to outline it in my book in a way that really conveys this fact, because this is the biggest fact about plastic. It doesn't go away, and it's also impossible to put it somewhere else. You know, we're just pushing it further down the line, but it's always harming someone else. It's not like it's going to just magically disappear and be gone. We have to deal with this problem. And so these communities of color have been fighting back for decades, but a big issue is a lack of transparency. A lot of times these communities are not told that some kind of new plastic infrastructure development is going to be built right in their backyards. And there's huge amounts of air pollution, water pollution, soil pollution that is emitted from these facilities. So that could be a recycling facility, a landfill, a transfer station, a refinery, a plastic production factory. It just, there's so many pieces of the plastic crisis that imperil people and really do change lives. I mean, besides doing this, they're contributing to the climate crisis. So, you know, these communities are really on the front lines of a lot of change, specifically thinking of when I went to St. James, Louisiana, because they were ravaged by the recent hurricanes. And yet they are surrounded by all this petrochemical development. And it's this crazy irony of, like, why do we keep doing this? It's very clear the suffering is there. So we have to just keep talking about it and allying ourselves with those communities that have been fighting back.
Enid and I, as you know, live on the East End, and I guarantee you in our lifetime we'll never see any type of facility out there, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah,
right?
Totally.
It's like they just keep it away and continue with their consumer selfishness, for want of a better word, right?
Right.
But it's disappointing because, as I was saying earlier to other people, you would think and expect that that the people who are in charge might have a little bit more of a conscience?
You would hope so. But money is swaying a lot of really racist and just biased decisions that are harmful. Part of it, too, is that a lot of this does happen in secrecy. And before others can maybe help intervene, even then it's too late. And it shouldn't be that we have to help. It should be that there are laws protecting people of all races, of all socioeconomic statuses, to not be exposed to industrial chemicals on a daily basis. I mean, even here on Long Island on the East End, not on the East End itself, but near the East End, in Brookhaven, we have the Brookhaven landfill. And that's right next to a school. That school's been evacuated several times for toxic, noxious fumes. And there are more cancer cases at that school, the Frank P. Long School. More than 30 cases in just a few dozen years. And that's really shocking. And that something like that is still allowed to continue specifically in a community of color where, they're not told what's going on. So that's a major problem. So we need some protections for people in these vulnerable communities.
Again, why do you think it's just so difficult to enact legislation to make meaningful change with respect to these types of issues? Why, in your opinion, why do you think that's the case?
There's a lack of representation from these communities. And part of that is that there's a lot of racism systemically in our society. And we have to overcome that to elevate the plight of people of all races. And it does take this, fundamental shift, and we all need to be on the same page and be on board with it. And as long as hate continues, we won't be there. And that's the sad truth about it. And I think conversations can help a lot. A lot of these groups are speaking to their neighbors and their communities. And I think the more that we, share these stories, that's what I do, at least in my work. I want people to understand that this is life or death, and we have to be on the right side of history. Mm-hmm. There's no point to be hateful.
If you were given a magic wand.
I wish.
Which we all wish we had.
Right?
Yeah. And to change this crisis, what would you do as a benevolent king or queen, I should say? What would we do concretely if I gave you the power to make change?
There are so many elements to it. And that's why in my book, I want to highlight these communities. So I'm going to say that first. There are communities and people doing amazing work, but there are so many ways that we have to address the crisis. So on one hand, it's addressing the injustice issue and making sure that these communities are helped and protected and remediated as well, because I know that there are a lot of toxins in these regions that need to be removed somehow. And we need to talk about that. How are we going to do that? We need to move to a zero waste type of lifestyle where, manufacturers of products are forced to consider their use of plastic. And that could mean, as Europe has already done, banning specific single use items. There's a list of 10 items that Europe has literally just banned, including plastic Q-tips and certain other plastic items. And they just should not be made anymore under their single use plastic directive. So it's like, get rid of any plastic you can't easily recycle. But then it's also, recycling has not been a success for plastic specifically. Most of the plastic that we have made, 8.3 billion tons of it, most of that, 79%, has been landfilled or incinerated. Landfilled or ended up in the environment. A smaller amount is incinerated, and an even smaller amount is actually recycled. And by the way, some of that that's labeled as recycled is actually just shipped to another country. I've spoken to people living in Turkey, and they find waste from the UK and Italy. And it's just a lot of, again, with the racism, because we're sending our stuff to developing nations and we think that they are going to deal with it. And it's not, it's often just incinerated or magically dumped into someone's backyard. So it's not, again, it's not going away. The plastic is still there.
I'm a little paranoid by nature, but it seems to me that it's like out of sight, out of mind. This is actually part of a, not a conspiracy, but certainly I can't really understand it.
Right.
Like, in other words, it's like everything, you get to the facts and you say, why isn't something being done? And things aren't ever done.
Right.
So then you start to say, like you said, the central question is money more important than human life? And so far, I would say we know the answer to that question.
Well,
so far.
So far of what others have decided.
Exactly.
But I know that a lot of people do care, and that's the heartening part of this. But if I'm waving my magic wand, I'm going to amplify and elevate all the people doing amazing work and make those corporations be held accountable. And they should be paying money to people to help them, because they've really ruined so many people's lives, and they've taken lives too.
It's so funny because I was thinking before I met you that one of the things that upset me was that recyclable where they charge the consumer.
Right.
And I said, well, wait a minute, why are they charging the consumer for these bags when we're not really responsible for their manufacture or distribution?
Exactly.
That was like the first question. Exactly. So then I said to myself, well, who got bought off on that one? But I really do admire your spirit and your positive energy regarding
Thank
this
you.
Issue. It's really nice. Again, the second part of the book, or I should say the third part of the book, talks about like actual ways we can replace plastic. I wanted you to get into that a little bit. So maybe science got us in this mess in one sense. Maybe it can help us get out of it.
So when it comes to replacing plastic, I like to think simple. I'm all about reuse of materials. And so if it doesn't have to be recycled, that's kind of the best option. That means we can reuse something without having to recycle it. So I have on the table my microplastic. It's in an old pickled beets jar. You know, like we have glass, we have metal. It can be used several times. It can be washed indefinitely. You know, it's not going to degrade like plastic does, which by when I say degrade, it means break up into little pieces that harm people and the environment. So I would say if we go back to traditional materials, it's only 70, 80 years ago that people were still using the milkman. They were still buying soda that was refilled. I have a lot of stories from our elders who've come to me saying, oh, I remember when this was like this and we didn't have plastic at all. And I would go to the store and get my bread and I would wrap it in a tea towel that I brought from home and then I would walk back. And fundamentally, what I've learned from this is that life used to not be so fast-paced. It used to not be centered around working and buying things. It was about, you know, just existing, forming communities, being with your neighbors. And in our we think our world is hyper-connected. It is globalized in some ways, but people are more far apart than ever before. And it's unbelievable. But I think that plastic has definitely aided in this separation. And so science, good old science, what can we do? So we can go back to the other materials. We can also use plant-based or bio-based materials. I've met a lot of scientists doing really cool stuff with bacteria, fungi, and starches and sugars. And they can make clothing, they could make water bottles, bags. But again, the focus should be to convert the lifestyle from throwing things away to zero waste. So that's the shift that we need.
What do you say to people who are just like at a point right now where they just throw their hands up? It's just, you know what I'm saying? One of the things when I read your book, it's really a great read. But
thank you.
But I started to feel like as one of 7 million, like, my God, what do we do?
Yeah.
So that's really, I guess that's what you're always kind of fighting as somebody who's an environmental activist, correct?
For sure. Or a lot of people come to me saying, what do I do? Like, what do we do? Like in a worry, panic. And yeah, it can feel really overwhelming. I try to focus on what I can do because we can all do something. We can't do everything. None of us can do everything. And the crisis will not be solved with kind of one sweep, which, you know, the magic wand. We wish that it was that easy. But I keep going and I keep encouraging people to either join efforts that already exist or use the knowledge that you have and that you can keep, you know, always keep learning. That's number one. But use knowledge to empower yourself. I've met people who've started their own nonprofit organizations after learning about the plastic crisis. People have started companies to make plastic-free stuff. I love that. Yeah, there's so many things that we could do. And even just being involved in your own community is an amazing place to be doing this work. And that's kind of, it seems to be one of the most successful ways to address the plastic crisis is within your own community first and then grow out from there.
So again, think local.
Act
locally.
Yeah. I think that is a place that we can see a lot of positive change. And I think you will feel encouraged because on that scale with people, you know, working together, that's the kind of community you need to make real change anyway. No one can do anything alone.
Right. And it also goes back to the interdependence of life and the fact that what I do influences you and vice versa.
Right.
Our audience is from the East End. We hope our audience is from the East. Well, it's going to be from everywhere. But specifically, what should Eastern Long Islanders be doing or thinking about? Because a lot of them are influential. Do you understand what I'm trying to say? Like, think locally. What could we do locally on the East End to make a difference? Because I know from personal experience that I go around cleaning up the beaches.
Right.
And one of the frustrating things is that I think it's clean and then I go back a week later and it's just as bad. So, but again,
it's not easy.
It's not easy because of those currents.
Yeah.
But go ahead. T- Tell me what you if you had a message for the East End of Long Island, which is still relatively beautiful in certain respects, more of a suburban kind of rural area, for want of a better word. But what would you say to those people out in the Hamptons?
Yeah, I would say take accountability for yourself and those around you. We have to hold others accountable too. So if you have friends or family who still use a lot of plastic, talk to them about it. Just have conversations. Concretely, I mean the East End in terms of garbage. Like, we want to be conscious of where our garbage is going. Find out, ask questions, be informed. I think that's the number one thing that you can do. Again, like, knowledge is power. You can really do a lot when you have information. And every community is facing a different level of this crisis at the moment, right? We talked about some communities that are really pressed by the plastic crisis, others less so. So yeah, get out there, talk to your neighbors, talk to your representatives, and understand the role plastic plays in your own life and question it. Every time I pick up something that is single-use plastic, I say to myself, do I really need this? And oftentimes the answer is no. So I put the thing down.
Right.
Yeah, and slowing down too. I mean, again, the East End is amazing. I love being out there, but it is very busy and it can be a bit hectic sometimes. Slow down and think about, you know, what's important to me. Is it the beautiful environment? Is it my family? Is it my kids? Or is it like buying more stuff in plastic?
As a former educator, what would you say to the children? I'm kind of embarrassed talking to young people now because of what we've done to the planet and what we continue to do. So what would you say to the kids of the world?
Yeah, well, luckily I've been able to work with a lot of young people. I do art workshops where I bring microplastic and we make paintings often of the things that we love. So sea turtles I've seen, fish, dolphins. And then we add plastic to that picture and then we talk about it, how that makes them feel. And it's not good. And children today are very aware of the problems. And I think they're growing up in a very privileged place because part of the reason why some of us have not been able to see like a sea change in the plastic crisis is because the corporations have been so good at keeping their intentions secretive. They've been painting it in a different light. You know, we get a lot of greenwashing going on. So children today have actually grown up with a lot more truth because luckily these communities that I've highlighted in my book, they've brought the truth to the table. And it's really remarkable that children today are really aware. I mean, every class that I speak to, some child, at least one, is like, I already told my parents we have to stop using plastic bottles or bags, or, you know, and it's really amazing. It's beautiful. So to children today, don't give up. As long as we keep fighting, you know, there's a reason we have to keep doing this, and we can't get just give up and be powerless. We all have power, and changes have been made. It can feel like nothing is happening because there's so much garbage all around us, but there is a lot of positive stuff happening too.
You mentioned in the book that scientists have a little leg up on the plastic crisis because of materials that they've studied. Could you go into that in a little bit of detail as well? Because again, you would think that in a perfect world that this danger that all of this poses, that they'd be obviously putting more resources and time into it. But what do you say about that?
I spoke to a bunch of scientists, so many for this book. And one of them that I spoke to was Edward Carpenter from San Francisco State University. And at the time he had been at Woods Hole. This is in the 1960s, 1970s. And he had been finding plastic in the ocean at that time. And this is only 20, 30 years after plastic started to be mass produced. Unbelievably, he told me that people from the plastic industry, from the Plastic Industry Association, that's a major trade group with huge lobbying power over legislation and plastic production. They went to his workplace at Woods Hole, and he thinks that that's the reason why he didn't get tenure, because he was threatened by these people from the plastic industry. And so the scientists have been doing the work for many decades. This is not, you know, plastic in the ocean is not a new thing. But if they had been able to speak up and speak out, could we have been further along in addressing the problem if 70 years ago the corporations didn't put that pressure on scientists? And also in the interim, I mean, the research about plastic has only really hit the mainstream in the past 15 years or so, 20 years or so, 15, 20 years, and really ramped up significantly in the last 5 years. So it's a lot of pressure from the corporations. And we have to also say, like, how do they get that power? What are they doing? This is, it's a very long conversation to explain everything and every nuanced detail. I've written a lot about it. But essentially, there is so much PR at play with the corporations. And the fossil fuel industry has done a similar thing with denying climate change is happening. And they just put out this messaging. Oh, you know, natural gas is less carbon emissions than oil or wood, and trying to sell these problems as solutions, whereas they really are not solutions. I've heard, you know, plastic is lightweight. It's going to be a low carbon future because everything will be plastic. Well, that's not true because plastic is carbon. It's just like nonsensical. So you really have to question everything and hold the corporations accountable. And that was something when plastic first came out. It was so new. Nobody really knew what it was all about. The formulation was proprietary. Scientists were saying, look, it's in the ocean. But then the companies were saying, oh, it's no big deal. So, you know, who listens to who? And so governments have played a role in this as well. And I don't want to understate that in sense of permitting plastic factories, permitting fossil fuel development, but also in allowing these messages. The so-called Crying Indian campaign from the Keep America Beautiful group, which is a group made by plastic and fossil fuel companies to look like it's a nonprofit that focuses on recycling. So I'm like literally telling you all these crazy stories, but it's all true. And this campaign, I talked to them recently, it was viewed something like 14 million times or some crazy number like that. It's in a story coming out soon, so I'll get you that number. But you think about that, it's like they play so many ads. They spent billions of dollars to get this in front of our eyes, and yet they still are billions of dollars richer than all of us are. And it's like, why are they having so much money, hurting people, hurting the planet, and putting these lies out there? So it literally has been
It's really been misinformation, right, from the very start.
100%.
So a lot of what we're seeing with respect to the crisis with COVID and the vaccination thing, we've been misinformed right from the start, right?
It's unbelievable with the fossil fuel and plastic industry how much misinformation they've put out about the risks that it poses, the material poses, about, you know, how the solutions are even presented. So these plastic industry groups have always focused on recycling. And we know only 9% of plastic has ever been recycled in the whole world from the 1950s. So,
incredible.
Yeah. And you're thinking,
I think most people would say that's a resounding failure in terms of recycling.
For sure. And it's not our failure. I mean, I go around my neighborhood every week and everyone has their bins out. Everyone has all their stuff. You know, they're doing the right thing. My mom, she separates everything and she's like, oh, I learned how to do this from you. And I'm like, yeah, but most of this is not going to be recycled anyway. And I don't want people to be deterred from putting things in the recycling bin. I mean, it's like we have the intention. That is good. That's a good sign. Don't get discouraged yet. But we have to push for change because we could recycle more and we're not. Part of that is like to get rid of plastics that are not very easily recycled. The problem with recycling is often you have to add new plastic to give it the same integrity as what you used before. So there's a lot of things to fix.
So like the climate crisis, we're sort of in a race now.
It's correct? A race. I mean, we're at the point where I've been in a study in Denmark. Well, I wasn't in the study, but I was in this researcher's room, and then we were discussing the study where they had a mannequin, and this is in my book. The mannequin breathed in 11 particles of plastic, like little microplastics per hour inside. And there's microplastic outside as well, we're finding, even in distant places like the Himalaya Mountains, where how many people are there here? There's the people that are living there. So it's unbelievable. It's a huge problem, but I don't want people to give up because we have to cling on till the end. We got to go down with our ship. At least I'm going to go down with my ship. I know that.
What can we do concretely as consumers or individuals to keep plastic at a minimum?
It's a great question. So I love shopping locally, going to farmers markets, bringing your own bags, bring your own mug to the coffee shop. There are just so many things. If you're talking about avoiding it in the foods you eat, well, you can be rest assured if you drink out of a plastic water bottle, there is so much more plastic in your diet than if you do not. And that goes ditto for anything, any beverage in plastic. It's always better to go for the tap. Eliminating it wherever you can is really important if you want to get it out of your diet. Unfortunately, fruits, vegetables, meats, they do have some microplastic in it. But if you buy packaged food, the risk of microplastic being in the packaged food. So it's basically eat clean, drink water out of the tap, use glass and metal wherever you can, and avoid, yeah, wrapping things in plastic.
Erica, really do appreciate you coming by and sharing a lot of this great information with us. And again, I wish you well in your quest.
My pleasure. Thanks for the great question.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for tuning in to Hampton's Consciousness. Enid and JB look forward to seeing you again in future episodes. Remember, the real Hamptons is not just mansions, beaches, and the rich, but a fragile, natural paradise made up of people who care about their community and the world west of Shinnecock Canal.